What's up, everybody? I actually recorded this segment originally to air for my subscribers on our overtime feed through Patreon, and I decided last minute to actually make it available to regular listeners because it's different than what I've been doing so far. All the stuff that I've released so far on Hidden Forces has been overtime. It's been extra audio that I've recorded with my guests from the previous episodes. But this is something new, and it's something that I'm going to be doing more of, which is calling up people, having impromptu conversations, not necessarily in the studio, about timely market events or events in politics, current affairs, technology, whatever it happens to be. And this is very much in line with that. I decided to do this last night. I saw something that Haseeb had written on Twitter related to the 51% attack against Ethereum Classic. I was actually interested in this attack, not so much about the attack itself, but more in terms of the minimal impact it had on Ethereum Classic's price and what that signifies, what that implies about the validity of the pricing that exists in cryptocurrencies, what the value is. It was a bizarre thing for me. Anyway, it also afforded us the opportunity to go down a number of threads, including a conversation about 51% attacks themselves, about ASICs, about the differences between proof of work in Ethereum versus proof of work in Bitcoin, also the efficacy of proof of stake, a lot of different things. So I thought it was super interesting and I wanted to make it available to you. If any of you are interested in subscribing to Hidden Forces, there are two ways to do that. You can either go into individual episode pages. So, for example, our most recent episode with Daniel Paris, you can open up that episode and inside you can see tabs for overtime, transcripts, and rundowns. And you can subscribe to any of the three different tiers through those tabs. Or you can just go straight to Patreon. It's patreon.com/hiddenforces, or you can put Hidden Forces in the search tab and you can find our page and you can read about the different subscriptions. So if you're interested, that's how I would recommend doing it. But for now, please enjoy this conversation with Haseeb Qureshi. Haseeb Qureshi, welcome to Hidden Forces.
Hey, happy to be on, man.
It's great having you on. So I want to give my audience some context for this conversation. I invited you onto the show because of a thread that you published on Twitter related to the recent 51% attack against Ethereum Classic, which was conducted against a relatively small exchange. I wasn't really interested in the attack itself. I wasn't necessarily interested in its implications, although those are important and interesting, and I do want to discuss them with you. But the reason that I even bothered to look into this in the first place was the fact that ETC's price, Ethereum Classic, was hardly impacted by the attack, which I find so incredibly bizarre. And it's something that I also want to ask you about. But let's take a step back, fill me and my audience in here. What happened? Give us some context here. And then I want to get into more detail about what a 51% attack is and what we can infer from this attack, its significance, implications for proof of work, proof of stake, etc.
Totally. So I'm going to assume a little bit of understanding of blockchains, but I'll try to go through
it. Yeah, you can assume that. You can assume that. And wherever necessary, I'll step in.
Cool. So basically what happened was that a few days ago, Ethereum Classic had a very, very massive block reorganization. Forks kind of happen naturally where the tip of the chain sort of changes just because people don't hear about each other. They step on each other's toes. It just sort of happens normally in distributed systems. But I think it was something like an 80 block reorganization, which basically never happens. And inside this 80 block reorganization, there was a double spend, meaning that a spend that was originally basically considered to be confirmed and part of the canonical chain, that spend was undone. And that spend was particularly going to an exchange called Gate.io, which is the smallish kind of Chinese exchange. And so the net effect of all of that is that whoever it is who caused this attack basically sent about 250K worth of Ethereum Classic to this exchange. They sold it for something else. We don't know exactly what they sold it for. They took out the other asset, and then they later reversed that transaction so that they basically got their 250K of Ethereum Classic back in addition to whatever else they made away with. So basically somebody stole a massive amount of money by breaking the security of the Ethereum Classic chain. So in order to kind of make, sort of flesh out that picture, I need to explain what a 51% attack is.
How much did you say this attack was for? How much did they manage to get out of it? I've heard conflicting numbers.
As far as I can tell, they took about $250,000.
Okay. So go ahead now. You were about to flesh out what a 51% attack is.
Yes. So in general, the whole principle behind proof of work is that whoever controls the most computational power basically controls the advancement of the blockchain, right? They control the blocks getting added to the ledger. So it's sort of assumed as part of the security model of blockchains that honest people who are just following the protocol normally control more than 50% of all the hash rate in the network. And so if you're an attacker and you want to try to control the network, well, you don't have more power than everybody else combined, because assuming everybody else is honest. Now, if you do, then all the guarantees of proof-of-work blockchains kind of break down. Okay, and that's basically what happened here. So if you are a very well-capitalized attacker and you want to perform a 51% attack, what you'll do is you'll buy up a bunch of hash rate. And hash rate basically here means the computational power required to do the proof of work. So you'll buy up more power than everybody else in the network combined. And if you can do that, then basically what you can do is you can start mining a different longer chain, but hold that chain behind your back. So you're sort of building up this chain, but not showing anyone. And so all the meanwhile, while you're building up this really long chain, everybody else who's honest is building up this totally other chain, which is doing honest stuff. And then eventually, after some period of time, you have this longer chain that's different, then you release it out into the world. And by the rules of proof of work, everybody has to switch over now to your longer chain. Because the rule in proof of work is that the longest chain wins. The longest chain is the correct chain.
There's an objectivity to which chain is the appropriate chain to build on, and that's based entirely on which chain is the longest.
Exactly, exactly. Technically, it's which chain has the most work, but we usually call it the longest chain.
Right. And let me interject quickly here. For anyone that's listening and is already lost because they don't understand some of the foundational aspects of proof of work or something else, I'm happy to explain those in a separate recording, and feel free to write in the comments of this audio or email me, and I'll make an effort to sort of expound on those things to try to help all of you make sense of this. But you were saying, Haseeb, just to restate it, There is a chain that's being built, which is the blockchain, which is a ledger of all the transactions that are happening organically at some point in time, time T.
Correct.
At that moment in time, an attacker decides that he or she is going to engage in a 51% attack. So what they do is they begin to replicate the existing chain, with the exception that whatever transactions they want to hide, in other words, whatever the double spend attack is going to be, those are not replicated in the chain that they're building behind their back. They're building that as they're conducting the attack. As, for example, the equivalent would be they walk into the bank. That's when the attack starts.
Right.
They open the vault. They begin to loot the vault. During the time that they're looting it, they're building a replica bank that doesn't have the looted cash. And when they close the vault, then they can swap out the two banks and they walk away and no one's the wiser. Well, not exactly no one's the wiser. That's when they figure it out.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of like I have a master ledger for that bank, right? And in the real bank, I go out and I withdraw a bunch of cash that I've deposited, right? But then later, I take their master ledger, I burn it up, and I replace it with this master ledger that I've been building behind my back, which says I still have money in the bank, right?
Good, even better analogy.
That's sort of, I think, a rough analogy of what a 51% attack looks like, where it involves a double spend. So basically, I withdrew my money, I like did the spend, but then later I undid that spend and did something else instead.
The difference being that it's much easier to swap out a paper ledger versus a cryptographically secure, permissionless database built on a proof of work chain.
Exactly. The way that I swap out a ledger in a proof of work chain is by solving a bunch of these computationally hard puzzles, like doing these proof of work puzzles, and I have to do as many of them as the rest of the network did, which requires just a shitload of power and energy and work.
And one of the reasons, the primary reason, of course, for that, the security reason at least, there are other reasons as well that we've talked about in episodes that we've done on Hashgraph, but the security reason is so that you can prevent an individual actor from easily accumulating the computational power to change the ledger or to propose new blocks.
Exactly. Like, that was one of the foundational assumptions behind Satoshi Nakamoto inventing proof of work when he created Bitcoin, was the assumption that he made that there are more honest people in the network than there are power controlled by a malicious person, right? So even if you are a malicious person, everybody else combined is more powerful than you. That's the assumption behind proof of work. And if that assumption breaks, then proof of work breaks.
So now, as I understand it, I think you were getting to this point, and if you were making a different point, please make it. But I think you were also making the point that the way this attack was conducted was that the attackers were able to rent the computational power, rent the graphics processors to conduct the attack, which they wouldn't, for example, have been able to do if these were not ASIC-resistant proof of work chains, algorithms, blockchains.
Yeah. So we should probably flesh out what some of those terms mean.
Sure.
Just so that your listeners are following. So I'll kind of flesh out the story of mining, cryptocurrency mining, and that'll kind of give some more color to why and how this exactly happened. So let's sort of rewind back before Ethereum Classic even existed to the early days of Bitcoin mining, okay? So let's imagine the year is 2010, Bitcoin is just launched, people start mining Bitcoin, right? And the whole idea of mining Bitcoin is that you run the Bitcoin mining software on your computer, and your CPU is like, you know, trying to solve all these SHA-2 hashes, which is the proof of work puzzle. And if you get lucky, then you solve the puzzle and then you make some money, right? And so basically it turns computational power, which requires both hardware and electricity, into money. That's the whole operation of mining, right? Now, as people started mining more and more Bitcoin, they realized like, hey, CPUs are actually nice. They're good for solving Bitcoin puzzles, but they're actually not super efficient because it turns out CPUs do a lot of stuff that you don't need when you're just doing Bitcoin mining, right? Like the CPUs are primarily weighted down by like making sure your operating system runs and being able to do just anything they want to. And, you know, all this executive functioning that is not necessary when you're doing something very basic like numerical computations. So it turns out that graphics cards are way faster at doing any of this kind of like really number crunching heavy stuff like Bitcoin mining. Turns out that's why graphics cards are also used for machine learning. So graphics cards turned out to be like the most dominant thing that people started using for Bitcoin mining. So at that point, nobody could make money mining on CPUs anymore because graphics cards dominated Bitcoin mining. As Bitcoin kept growing and growing, it turned out that like, well, if you want to go above graphics cards, like graphics cards still do a lot of stuff that you don't need for Bitcoin mining, right? Like they have these sort of like the vector graphics and, you know, 3D ray tracing or whatever, all this stuff that you need for graphics that is actually irrelevant to Bitcoin mining. And so as Bitcoin became bigger and bigger, an industry developed around people developing specialized hardware purely for Bitcoin mining. And the principle in hardware is that the less shit you need, the more you can get rid of and the more efficient you can make your hardware at that particular task.
Yeah, just to interject here, the major sort of overarching theme of what you're describing is a search for optimal efficiency, maximum efficiency of the hardware used to mine the cryptocurrency in question.
100%. So taken to the limit, eventually what that led to is the development of what are called ASICs. So ASIC is an acronym, stands for Application-Specific Integrated Circuit. And an ASIC is basically literally the logical extension of this idea that you remove everything else from the machine, right? There's no longer, you know, a memory bank. There's no longer, you know, a graphics card or a sound card or any of that stuff. You don't need any of that if you're just Bitcoin mining, right? Literally an ASIC is just basically a circuit board that all it can do is it can mine Bitcoin. It's not programmable. It's not a computer in any meaningful sense. It is just a circuit that mines Bitcoin. And because there's nothing else on it, it is extremely fast, extremely energy efficient, and extremely effective at mining Bitcoin relative to anything else that is capable of mining Bitcoin. And so there's been an industry developed of what are now called ASICs and ASIC farms, which are basically these giant server farms of just ASICs that mine Bitcoin. So today, you can only mine Bitcoin effectively using ASICs. If you use anything else, if you use like your graphics card or your computer, you will not be able to mine enough Bitcoin to make it even remotely worth it relative to the cost of just the electricity. And so this has led to the coins that developed after Bitcoin saw this. They saw the development of this ASIC industry and they didn't like it. Because ASICs, of course, are things that basically only a professional miner living in, you know, Iceland or Canada or China, who's running this as a literally a massive operation and a profession, can do any of this kind of mining. That means that normal everyday users like you and me can't mine any Bitcoin. We can't participate in this practice of securing the network.
We can't compete with the ASICs. How much more advanced is an application-specific integrated circuit used to mine Bitcoin versus, say, the most advanced graphics processing unit?
Relative to a graphics card, I don't know the exact multiple, but it's at least a factor of like 100, if not more.
Yeah, substantially more.
Substantially more efficient.
The important point is that these are static, right? They can't be repurposed to mine Ethereum. They can't be repurposed to do anything else. They were built to do this, and that's only it. And if they don't do this, they can't do anything.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. These are basically like light bulbs that just mine Bitcoin and nothing else. They are dumb machinery that can only do one thing. So after the development of this ASIC industry, a lot of later coins that were developed, such as Ethereum, which, you know, Ethereum only launched in 2015. Bitcoin was created in 2008, 2009. A lot of these later coins that developed realized that this is kind of not predicted, but really shitty outcome, that you have this like really centralized industry of specialized hardware for mining cryptocurrencies. And they decided, look, we don't want this. We want to use mining algorithms that you can't build ASICs for. And it turns out there are ways to develop your mining algorithm such that it's much harder to build an efficient ASIC that does much better than a graphics card, right? Just to kind of give you a crude example of how this might be done, imagine that your mining algorithm required for you to like render a bunch of video game scenes, right? That's exactly the kind of thing that a graphics card is good at. And if you wanted to build something that was better at doing that, well, you would just have built a better graphics card, right? And so if you build a mining algorithm that basically kind of looks like the sorts of things that graphics cards are good at, then voila, you've built something that you can't build an ASIC for, because the ASIC is just a graphics card, right? That is the most efficient machine that can do that thing. So Ethereum, for example, uses an algorithm called Ethash, which is designed to be ASIC resistant. It's designed such that ASICs are very hard to build for this thing that do better than graphics cards. Now, in practice, there have been ASICs that are built for Ethash. And so Ethereum Classic, the chain that was attacked, has the same mining algorithm as Ethereum. And so it also uses Ethash. But there have been ASICs developed, but they're about 2 times more efficient, roughly, than graphics cards. So graphics cards are still competitive, and you can still mine Ethereum profitably, or at least you could for a while, using graphics cards. But there's probably going to be a widening gap slowly as ASICs get better and better for
Ethereum.
So
the same machines that are used to mine for Ethereum are also used to mine for Ethereum Classic?
Yes, because the exact same hardware, the exact same algorithm.
And all of these machines, but to your point, even if there are ASICs, you can still be competitive running a graphics processor.
Yes, you can run GPUs, graphics cards.
Right, GPUs.
Yes, using a CPU would be just so horribly inefficient that there's no way you'd make money mining with like your laptop, right? But if you have like a gaming rig with like multiple, you know, 1080 Ti or whatever they are, graphics cards installed, then you could make some money doing that potentially. So the way that you cash that out in the context of this attack is that it turns out that graphics cards are pretty fungible. There are a lot of graphics cards out there. There are a lot of reasons to have graphics cards. You know, you use them for machine learning. You use them for mining many, many different cryptocurrencies. And so it turns out you can rent graphics cards pretty easily. And you know, people do this routinely on AWS all the time. So the person who ended up attacking Ethereum Classic, it turns out that if you just look at some of these places where you can rent graphics cards, it costs about $5,000 an hour to rent all the graphics cards necessary to 51% attack Ethereum Classic, basically meaning the total amount of hash power dedicated to Ethereum Classic at any given time is less than $5,000 per hour, which is pretty crazy low.
Very low bar of security for proof of work blockchain.
Exactly, exactly. So Ethereum Classic, I don't know the exact market cap of Ethereum Classic, and market cap is kind of a very, very crappy, crude measurement for the value of a currency. But the market cap of Ethereum Classic is like in the hundreds of millions. I don't know exactly where it is.
The point is it's sufficiently small that it could be attacked relatively cheaply.
Yes.
And not just cheaply, but where the GPU cycles required to attack it are available for rent.
Exactly. You can rent 100% of the GPUs required to 51% attack Ethereum Classic. Now, if you look at Ethereum, right, Ethereum is a massive network, much more hash rate than Ethereum Classic. You could rent as many GPUs as you could on the market and still not make a dent in the Ethereum hash rate because there's just so many GPUs and ASICs at work defending Ethereum. But Ethereum Classic was so much smaller in terms of the hash rate that you could just rent it all from your computer chair. You don't have to go up and like spin up a mining farm. You just need to swipe your credit card and you're good to go.
So I want to interject here and ask you something because I could wait later to ask you, but I feel like it's an opportune moment. And I do want to get into more specific things about the exchanges, what the sort of profile is of an exchange that would be attacked, and what the exchanges can do. But the question that I think is on the minds of at least some of my listeners in this moment is, why would anyone want value denominated on a ledger that has such a small market capitalization where the hash rate required to attack it is so small and the exchanges that trade it can be attacked in such a manner so that people are incentivized to attack it so that you're this unsafe? Why would anyone want that? And why is that not reflected in the price? In other words, why did the price only drop, what was it, 7%? That is something that I don't understand. And I feel like a lot of other people are not going to understand.
Right.
What can you do to explain to me and to our listeners why the price has been largely not affected by this attack?
So I can try to answer that question from a few different angles. That's what I'm going to try to do, with the caveat that I don't think any of these answers are individually very satisfying. But I think part of what motivated me writing this tweetstorm was sort of the same impulse that you're pointing to, which is that this doesn't feel very satisfying. I don't really understand why Ethereum Classic was not totally destroyed by this attack. So let's sort of assume that we are living in a world where it makes sense that Ethereum Classic wasn't totally destroyed. So let's start with the first question of why would anyone want to hold this in the first place? The answer why anyone would want to hold Ethereum Classic in the first place is one of two reasons. One, you're a speculator. If you're a speculator, you basically believe that, look, Ethereum Classic is 2 or 3 orders of magnitude cheaper than Ethereum. And, you know, maybe it's like, let me actually just look up what Ethereum Classic's market capitalization is. I'm guessing it's on the order of like 400 million or something. So Ethereum itself is about $13 billion in market cap. Ethereum Classic is about $500 million in market cap, right? So basically, it's a factor of 25 smaller than Ethereum. You might say that, like, well, you know, that's 4% the size of
but
Ethereum.
But also, just to interject again,
yes.
If anything, I mean, I understand that Ethereum Classic was the original Ethereum and that Ethereum, as it is today, was born out of the DAO fork. Mm-hmm. But Ethereum is an attempt to create a utility protocol blockchain. It's an attempt Correct. To build a Turing-complete machine that is operating in a permissionless environment. It's a very different value proposition than what Ethereum Classic is, which is basically Bitcoin. I mean, in terms of its functionality, Ethereum Classic is just a cryptocurrency and nothing more, nothing less.
Well, that's not exactly correct.
No,
Ethereum
it's
Classic
not.
Does
okay.
have all the functionality of Ethereum in that it has smart contracts, it has...
But who builds
on it? It is
literally
Ethereum.
Right.
Just, you know, sort of a snapshot of Ethereum roughly from 2 years ago.
But no one's building on it. I mean, it has no. Is there a single?
It does have a development team. I haven't followed Ethereum Classic very closely, so I don't want to speak too specifically on what they have or haven't implemented. But my understanding is that there is a development team. They're trying to keep pace with Ethereum development, and they have some degree of their own roadmap. I think most people would say that Ethereum is clearly going to out-innovate Ethereum Classic because there's just orders of magnitude more resources devoted to Ethereum than there is to Ethereum Classic. But the people who are speculating on Ethereum Classic are basically presumably saying that they think there's more than a 4% chance that Ethereum Classic turns out to beat Ethereum for some reason.
Wait, is it unfair to compare? I'm going to go super analog here, but it's almost like, you know, in Cuba, what were they, GM's cars that were back in Cuba in the 1950s? Once communism fell over the country, those cars never changed. I mean, they were basically upgrading, fixing
right.
an entirely new ecosystem developed in Cuba that probably got more power out of those cars than any other place in the world ever did. Mm-hmm. But they were limited by the community, by what they were working with. They never evolved
right.
past that.
Right.
It feels like ETC is something similar, so that whatever the value is of ETC is pretty much in sort of based in the relic of what it was. I don't know. I mean, in any case, I don't want to go too far off the map there.
Sure,
but...
sure. I don't want to get into too much speculation because I don't know
development. Me neither, actually.
At all, basically. Sort of zoom out a second, okay? So the speculators are basically people who believe that, look, I think Ethereum Classic might win. And is that reasonable to the tune of, you know, 4% chance of overtaking Ethereum? I don't know, maybe. Who knows? But that's
an interesting thing, though.
I guess
that's the thing that it's hard for me to believe. That's the thing I find confusing, that they're speculating on it because they think it would win, or maybe they're just speculating on it because they believe that there is this community of... You and I had a quick conversation before this.
Mm-hmm.
I came up with some name for like the Hulu Gulu or whatever, some tribe in some, you know,
right.
Amazonian corner of the Amazon, where they're speculating simply because they've identified a very small, you know, 100-person tribe of ideologues who have a very strict perception of the world, and they're able to take advantage of their commitment to this ideology irrespective of what's going to happen. And
right.
so there's some kind of floor to that, and that's where the value of the speculation is. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, cryptocurrencies are not just valuable for their technology. They're also valuable for their community. And
yeah.
You know, some people might claim that, look, the Ethereum Classic community is awesome. It's powerful. It's vibrant. It's going to grow. I don't know.
That's what makes more sense to me. That's what makes more sense to me. The religious
right.
argument makes more sense to me than the
right.
viewing this from a traditional, you know, dollars and cents, meat and mm-hmm. potatoes perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, somebody is saying that this tiny currency is worth 1/25th of Ethereum.
To them. Yeah.
And... You know, I don't know how to judge small probabilities. I think in general, people are terrible at that.
That's a fair point.
And maybe they're right, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think that Ethereum Classic has a 1/25th chance of, you know, usurping the throne from Ethereum, but they may know something I don't.
Or they just, to the point that maybe we're viewing it in the wrong lens of saying what is their probability of usurping Ethereum, and simply put, that there is a community of people that simply values this at X. And that reflects a different value system. But regardless, the point is the price has been remarkably resistant. And to your point, trying to understand exactly why it may be a lost cause. And
yeah.
I interrupted you when you were making, I think, a more important point.
Yes. So the question more generally is, okay, when something gets 51% attacked, right? It sort of seemed for a very long time, and this is something that I believe that I espoused, is that if a currency gets 51% attacked, that should basically destroy that currency. That should basically be a sign that, okay, you know, proof of work rests on this assumption that nobody malicious owns more than 50% of the hash rate. And when that assumption is proven to be broken, that's the end of the game. That's, you know, okay, great, the cool experiment, we're done now, it failed, right? And we can now pretty safely put that thesis to rest. We know that that's wrong. because it turns out, you know, Ethereum Classic is not the only currency that was 51% attacked in the last year. There was also Bitcoin Gold, there was Verge, there have been several others, Zencash, I think Vertcoin, I believe. And in all of those coins that were 51% attacked, most of them did not lose significant amounts of value if they lost value at all. And so this is now enough of a pattern that if we are not drawing inferences from this pattern, we're not doing our jobs as rational thinkers. And so how do we make sense of the world in which when a currency gets 51% attacked, it doesn't significantly lose a lot of value? So I started thinking about this really deeply because I didn't really have a good answer to this question. And the conclusion that I came to is the following. So in a 51% attack, most of the time what you're going to do is you want to double spend against somebody, right? So you want to revert a transaction that you did earlier on in the chain. Now, if you're going to have a 51% attack, you're probably not going to do it against some random person, because random people don't tend to have a lot of money, right? If you want to rob somebody who has a lot of money, you're going to rob a bank. You're not going to rob some random individual on the street. So the banks in crypto are exchanges, because exchanges are primarily where the, you know, big sources of capital are. If you look at the biggest holders of any cryptocurrency, they're almost always exchanges. So naturally, if you want to double spend and get some other asset out, the counterparty is going to be an exchange. And thus, if you're going to 51% attack and double spend on somebody, the natural person to do that against is an exchange. That means the exchange is the one who loses the money as a result of that 51% attack. So if you're an average person, right, let's say you're transacting on Ethereum Classic. If the double spend happened while you were transacting with your friends or using some dApp or whatever it was you were doing, most likely your transactions were left intact. Because when the attacker was creating their parallel chain that they were building behind their back, you know, they might as well have included about your transactions.
They're not worried about your transactions or your account specifically.
Exactly, exactly. But the thing is,
basically
they're not just
the exchange's account. They're hacking the exchange's account. Or another way, just to interject, if you're at a bank and a robbery is in progress and the attackers open up the safe and loot the bank, your money is safe. Your money is safe because it's insured by the federal government or because it's part of the larger insurance that the bank has against its reserves. The money is fungible, and what the bank loses, it's against its own account, not against the individuals who are exchanging on it.
Sure. I think that's a good way to think about it. In essence, it's actually in the attacker's interest when they build this parallel chain to include your transactions in their parallel chain, because all of your transactions pay transaction fees. So actually, they strictly make more money in their attack if they include your transactions, so why not do that, right? At the end of the day, because the whole point of a double spend is to make away with some more of the original asset, it's also actually in the attacker's interest to keep the value of that asset alive. Because, you know, the whole point of a double spend is like, I sent you 100K or of Ethereum Classic, but then I revert that transaction and keep that 100K of Ethereum Classic for myself. If I crater the price of Ethereum Classic, I'm just hurting myself.
You want to maximize the amount of money you can get per individual victim.
Exactly.
You don't want to have so many victims that it's going to create a problem either for the value of the currency or for maybe, again, ATC is unique in that or interesting in that it's the pure version of Ethereum. It's where the community has said, code is law, here is proof. It's sort of in our canonical foundation. But if you attack enough of the network, if enough of the network loses, those people are going to be incentivized to push for a redress, to kind of walk that back, right? I mean, I don't know how to describe it. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's not just in that you're going to cause a governance crisis of much larger proportions if you just like screw over everybody else
in
the network.
Exactly.
For no
reason. That's a great governance crisis. Exactly.
Right. But also, it just literally means that more people will be disenfranchised and no longer want to transact on Ethereum Classic, which is what gives Ethereum Classic value in the first place.
Yeah.
So in essence, like, you kind of prefer an attack where you very targetedly attack the fattest cat on the block, but leave everybody else still participating in the network.
Great analogy.
In this case, that's exchanges, right? So if you zoom out far enough and you sort of ignore all the ethics or the mechanics of the attack, what 51% attacks end up looking like is just sort of, you know, background level of ambient violence on exchanges, or sort of like a tax on exchanges. That exchanges just get 51% attacked every once in a while. They sort of dust themselves off and they say, okay, great, we got to do better next time. But nobody else gets hurt by it, because there's no reason for an attacker to hurt anybody else through a 51% attack.
You know, it's really interesting. It's just an important thing to also point out. One of the supposed reasons for the existence of a cryptocurrency is the lack of centralization, right? You're supposed to be decentralized. And here is case in point the problem with exchanges and sort of the paradox. which is that many of these currencies are very difficult. All of these currencies are difficult to transact in, which is why exchanges have popped up in order to make it easier for the average person to transact and hold cryptocurrency. And yet the exchanges are a central point of attack. If you didn't have exchanges, it would be way more difficult to conduct this type of attack because you'd have to find an individual with the net worth of an exchange, which would be extremely unlikely, correct? Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Not only that, but the particular kind of transaction you need to do is very specific to do a double spend effectively, because you would need to trade, you know, let's say there is some person who's very, very rich and has a lot of Ethereum Classic. You would need to trade them a lot of Ethereum Classic for something else on a different chain or something off chain.
They'd have to own it. They'd also, exactly.
Yes. So it needs to be like US dollars or Bitcoin or something else that when you revert the chain, you're not reverting the thing you got in exchange.
And no individual is going to be conducting that many transactions where it's not going to raise an alarm bell to have someone come to them to want to exchange so much value. Again,
exactly.
They're a prime target for a number of reasons.
Exchanges are the prime target.
Yeah, that's so right. Continue. You were making some great points.
So at the end of the day, this seems to me like the most plausible explanation for why it is that when these currencies get 51% attacked, and Ethereum Classic is only the latest example, they don't tend to lose a lot of value. My conclusion was that it must be that the market is internalizing this as, oh, okay, this is a tax on exchanges. It doesn't really affect the fundamental value or price of the currency because nobody else is going to get affected by these. The reason why then the price must have dropped would be because when an exchange gets 51% attacked, it is potentially a sign that that exchange or other exchanges may delist the asset in question, right? So it might be that the reason why the market faltered, that 7%, was pricing in the risk that, oh, crap, maybe now Coinbase or Gate.io, the victim exchange, or other exchanges may start delisting Ethereum Classic and that will remove liquidity.
Right, exactly. So we covered a number of sort of different threads there. The thing that I think is even more specific to what you tweeted about are countermeasures that exchanges can implement in order to prevent these types of attacks against them. So why don't you sort of expound on that, some of the deterrence models or the deterrence model that you were putting forward?
Yeah. So basically, if you assume this is a problem localized to exchanges, then exchanges basically, you know, I sort of put forward a couple of recommendations to them. One of them is pretty obvious. And the obvious one is start delisting these currencies that have liquidity but very low hash rates and that are secured by proof of work. Because these, in general, are exactly the kinds of things that are going to get 51% attacked. Now, the second recommendation I made is kind of a little bit more theoretical and kind of wacky, but I'll try to describe it in broad strokes. So let's turn back the clock to this 51% attack. Let's say they were trying to double spend $100,000 worth of Ethereum Classic. So what they're doing, you know, they're mining this chain behind their back to try to do this big, long double spend. They deposit 100K of Ethereum Classic on the exchange. Then they withdraw to US dollars, right? Eventually the US dollars hit their bank account. And the moment that happens, they're like, cool, now I'm going to reverse my Ethereum transaction deposit in the first place by releasing their double spend, which let's say that's two blocks longer than the current chain. Okay. And so because it's two blocks longer, all of the honest participants in the network will immediately switch over to this longer chain because it's longer and that's the rule that you have to follow in proof of work. So the moment that happens, the exchange is going to recognize, oh shit, there was a big long block reorganization, like there was a fork like 40 blocks back or some, you know, really long number of blocks back, and that caused a double spend. We are now in the hole for that 100K that we thought we just paid this guy out. We just lost it, right? So right now what ended up happening was that the exchange was like, oh shoot, isn't that unfortunate? Let's go do an investigation. And my proposal is, what if instead, the moment that an exchange realized this happened, the exchange went to the exact same, you know, online marketplace, rented some GPUs, and then started mining on the old chain. And if the exchange basically started mining on the old chain to try to extend the old chain where they still had the 100K and everything was hunky-dory, and they extended it past the current chain, because, you know, let's say it cost the attacker's trying to make 100K by doubling their money, by withdrawing the US dollars and keeping the Ethereum Classic. So they spent, by definition, less than 100K on that attack, otherwise it wouldn't have been worth it. So their hash rate required to do that big long fork cost them, let's say, I don't know, $30,000. Well, so the exchange, because it doesn't need to fork 40 blocks back, it just needs to like take that older chain that was like a few blocks shorter and make it like, let's say, five blocks longer, right? That should take maybe, I don't know, a few thousand dollars. So they spend a few thousand dollars, extend that older chain forward, and now that's the longest chain again, and the attacker, their fork is no longer the longest chain, everybody reverts back to where the exchange was. So the exchange is happy, but the attacker is like, wait, shit, I spent all this money. I was going to make off with this 100K and I lost my attack. You should expect then what the attacker will do is go back and do the same thing again. They'll try to extend that big chain they made and try to get it longer. And the exchange should see that and then do the same thing. And you should see like this tug of war.
Yeah, you're right. Tug of war, exactly.
Exactly. Where each of them is trying to extend their chain longer. And it turns out if you sort of play out the game theory, this should end up looking like a dollar auction. So a dollar auction is a very famous game theory experiment where basically you have two people running an auction on a dollar bill. And the idea is that both people end up having to pay the amount that they bid. So let's say you and I are bidding on a dollar. Let's say I bid 1 cent and then you bid 2 cents. And I'm like, well, shit, okay, I'm going to bid 3 cents. And then you bid 4 cents. And we keep going up and up. But the idea is that each of us has to pay the bid we made even if we lost the auction, right? And this is all known as like a ruinous auction because what often ends up happening is that both of us end up bidding more money than makes any sense at all. Like you're betting 99 cents and I end up betting a dollar. Then you're like, wait, why am I going to bet a dollar and 1 cent to get a dollar back?
The solution to that be by proposing, let's say in the auction, some amount way above the incremental amount needed to actually take the auction?
So generally speaking, the way you can circumvent that from a game theoretic perspective is by creating some kind of credible pre-commitment that I will bet up to a dollar no matter what you do, right? And if I can prove that, such as, for example, by, I don't know, making a bet with somebody else that if I don't do that, I have to pay him a bunch of money, then you're like, shit, this guy definitely has to bet at least a dollar. So if I bet anything at all, he will keep betting me up to a dollar. So unless I'm willing to bet more than a dollar to win that dollar, there's no point in me playing, right? Mm-hmm. So the way that you win a ruinous auction is by making a pre-commitment that you're going to spend at least that amount of money and making the other person just decide
not to
play.
That's like playing a game of chicken but tying the car wheel so that you can't possibly get out of the way of the other car.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So let's bring this back to the forking blockchain case, right? In this case, you have this attacker and you have the exchange and they're each spending money to try to extend their chain because they can like basically win this tug of war and get that 100K worth of Ethereum Classic, right? What will probably end up happening is that they're doing this ruinous auction one increment at a time, right? And eventually the attacker will give up because they'll realize like, oh shit, this exchange is like insistent on winning this 100K from me, right? Now, if that ends up happening, like the first time that happens, right? One might imagine that the attacker spends 100K, the exchange spends 100K, and the attacker gives up because they just doubled their loss. And the exchange is like, well, whatever, you know, I lost 100K, you know, I won back my 100K, but I spent 100K, so overall I lost 100K. But now any future attacker that tries to do this again is going to know, look, if you try to double spend on me, I will double spend through the hole. I don't care how much money I have to spend. I will ruin you by just continually pushing the other side of that chain until I come out with all my money intact, right? And as attackers realize this, that will totally shift the incentives such that attackers no longer are incentivized to even try to double spend against exchanges. Because if they do, exchanges will expend any amount of money necessary to protect their original chains.
In what instances would this be profitable for an exchange to do, whereas instead of just simply delisting this, is this something where the largest exchanges are going to end up being able to be the only ones that the trading of things like Ethereum Classic or coins with sufficiently lower market caps are going to happen on an increasingly smaller number of exchanges as other exchanges start to delist them?
So I think it's in reality, the proposal that I listed is pretty far-fetched and very unlikely to happen for a lot of just kind of operational and legal reasons. But most likely what will end up happening with some of these currencies is that either one of two things. Either one, they will just be delisted outright because of the fact that, look, it's just kind of not worth really dealing with the fact that they have such a low hash rate and there's double spends and, you know, the market cap is expected to go down if the hash rate goes down. But the other alternative is that let's say that Ethereum Classic, despite all this, still has enough interest from traders that they're willing to trade it and, you know, it produces trading fees and that's how exchanges make their money. Most likely what they'll just do instead is radically increase the number of confirmations required before Ethereum Classic deposits are considered to be confirmed. So right now,
that makes sense.
It might have been like, okay, 40 blocks you have to wait for Ethereum Classic transaction to be confirmed. And that's, I don't know, maybe like, you know, half an hour. And they might just say, look, so gate.io, I believe, increased the confirmations up to 400, which is really a long, I don't know how much time that actually takes, but let's say it's like 6 hours, right? So that allows them to still maintain the same security level. They're just like sort of increasing the amount of money that would be required to double spend. Now, in the limit, if exchanges started having this be more and more of a serious problem, probably what they'd have to do is basically just do something a little bit more complex than what they're currently doing. So right now, what people are currently doing is they're basically saying, look, this number of confirmations is basically enough that we're going to consider it, you know, unforkable past this point, right? And that's just basically on the basis of, okay, it costs about, you know, $100 to mint a block. Therefore, you just multiply that by 400. That's a lot of money. So we don't think anyone's going to double spend that much, right? But what is sort of more reasonable to do is just parameterize the number of blocks by the amount of money you're sending. So if I'm sending to an exchange $1 million, then they're just going to say, okay, well, if you're double spending on us, then you would need to mine at least like 10,000 blocks. So we're going to say, look, this, because it's such a large send, we're going to make you wait 10,000 blocks, which is
that
like,
makes a
know,
lot
like
of sense.
5 days or something, right? Now, in practice, exchanges don't do this because it's kind of complicated. The users kind of find this to be a really crappy experience to like have to wait and not be able to predict exactly how long it's going to take to settle and like move between exchanges. And in reality, of course, traders are naturally very sensitive to time. So there are reasons why exchanges haven't done this. But in the limit, if you can imagine this sort of, you know, Wild West, you know, kind of Mad Max type world where 51% attacks happen all the time and they're just totally unavoidable, that might be the world we end up going to if exchanges insist on listing these currencies that are readily available for 51% attacks.
So we got a few more minutes left. What are your thoughts, just preliminarily, on whether or not what this does to validate some of the arguments for moving to proof of stake, which I think a number of people in the Ethereum community have been making after this attack?
Yeah. So I think that's a very fair point to make. In proof of stake, these 51% attacks are much harder and much riskier to do. And there's a very simple reason for this. So in a proof of work chain, let's say that, you know, we're sort of in a doomsday scenario where a very well capitalized attacker, such as a nation state, decides they just want to destroy Bitcoin or they just want to destroy Ethereum, right? They don't even care about making money. They just want to drive it into the ground and they're going to use the proof of work model to break it. Right. And so the way they might do that is they might buy a shitload of GPUs and get them all to work. And all they're going to do is mine empty blocks. OK, meaning that the blocks contain no transactions in them. They're not advancing the ledger in any way. They're basically freezing the ledger. And you can do that if you own more than 50% of the hash rate, because all the blocks you create will be longer than the other longest chain and they'll all be empty. Right. So it's almost like a DOS attack against the Ethereum network. If you did that, there's not really a good way to get around this. Right. From Ethereum's perspective, they don't really know who's doing this. They don't know how to stop them. And anytime that you say, okay, well, we're going to change the mining algorithm to be this instead, the attacker who still controls a bunch of GPUs can just follow you and do that algorithm instead, right? If they have enough money, technically speaking, they can own enough hash rate to just break your coin, right?
Because you're using ASIC resistant algorithms.
Exactly, exactly. So Vitalik calls this a spawn camping attack, right? And so the analogy is like, if you imagine, you know, a first person shooter game, like you'd imagine like GoldenEye, right? For the N64. People spawn in certain locations, right? You can just stand right where they're spawning. And the moment they start a new mining algorithm, shoot them in the head again. And you can basically just take the same hardware and follow them around wherever they're going and destroy them as soon as they appear, right? And that's sort of the kind of the scourge of proof of work, is this idea that if you own enough hardware, you can basically break anything. Mm-hmm. Now, with proof of stake, this is kind of less true. Okay, and I can sort of give you a rough intuition for why this is. So, you know, before proof of stake was called proof of stake, the idea, the germ that led to proof of stake was this idea of what's called virtual mining, right? I mean, it sort of came from, I think, an intuition a lot of people have, which is that, okay, proof of work kind of makes sense. I get why it works, but it's really wasteful. It's really kind of inelegant in a lot of ways, like that we have to expend all this computational energy. Is there a way to like simulate proof of work? Sort of pretend in our minds that we were doing proof of work, but nobody actually does the proof of work and the hashes and the electricity, right? And the idea of virtualized mining is like, well, or simulated mining, is that let's imagine that you bought an ASIC, right? Because the whole idea of proof of work mining is that you buy some hardware and then you expend some capital continuously using that hardware, and that's how the network is secure. Well, you can sort of analogize that by saying, okay, instead of buying hardware, you're going to lock up coins, right? By locking up coins, it's kind of like buying hardware, because what do you know, you buy hardware with money, coins are money. So we'll just sort of like turn your coins into like these locked up coins, which are sort of like, imagine they're ASICs, right? Well, okay, what's the mining? Well, the mining is like the cost of capital, because the locked up coins are locked, you can't do anything with them, and you're paying the opportunity cost of that capital sitting there doing nothing, right? And that sort of becomes like the sort of continual electricity expenditure. And so in proof of stake, the work that's being done is by this locked up capital that's sitting there doing nothing except, you know, being the locked up capital that entitles you to proof of stake rewards. Now, let's say that in proof of stake, China or some other bad actor, Russia, whoever, I don't know, some nation state that has a ton of capital, decides they want to destroy Ethereum. They lock up a bunch of coins and then they start doing bad things. Well, in a proof of stake network, you can actually see the person who did the bad thing, right? Because they have coins. They actually voted on stuff using their coins. And because all this lives in the blockchain, you can see exactly which address did what. And all of their coins live exactly somewhere on chain. And so what you could do is say, hey, everybody, let's get on Twitter, let's get on Reddit, let's notice that, like, hey, look, here's a bunch of proof that this address did a bunch of bad stuff and like try to break the chain. Let's all fork, let's create a new chain. And on this new chain, everything is the exact same as on the old chain, except this person's coins are all deleted, right? That is sort of analogous to as though the moment that somebody attacked you, you could go take all of their ASICs or all their GPUs and just delete them from the universe, right? That's basically what proof of stake lets you do. And this model essentially gives you a lot more robustness against this kind of very coordinated 51% attack. So proof of stake has a number of other weaknesses that it comes with, but this is one of the strengths of proof of stake versus proof of work, is that this kind of attack comes with much, much higher costs. Because if there's some kind of social consensus among the people who participate in that network that, hey, this is a bad thing and this is the person who did it, you can punish them much more dramatically than you can in proof of work by literally deleting all of their capital from the canonical chain.
And that, of course, speaks to the larger conversation of governance. And that's something that we've talked about a bit on our episodes, I think episode 36 and episode 22 with Lehman Baird, around Hashgraph primarily, because that was an opportunity to discuss governance. Haseeb, I know you got to go. I thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and for sharing these thoughts with my audience.
Yeah, anytime. It was a lot of fun.